Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey everyone, and welcome to a perpetual feast here on the Circe Institute Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, a producer here at the Circe Podcast Network, and before we kick it over to the show with Wes Callahan and Andrew Kern, I just need to say a quick word from our sponsor. Roman Roads Media is a publisher of classical Christian curriculum designed for homeschoolers and homeschool co-ops, and they're back this year with a giveaway for Circe Podcast listeners. Each episode of Perpetual Feast, they're going to be giving away one of the 16 units from Wes Callahan's Old Western Culture Series, a high school video course that guides you through the great books of Western Civ. Complete with workbooks, discussion, questions, and readers, Wes Callahan draws from decades of teaching experience as he tells the story of Western civilization, integrating history, literature, theology, politics, philosophy, and so much more. Here's how to enter this giveaway. When this episode is posted on our Facebook page, on the Circe Facebook page, leave a comment saying which unit of the Old Western Culture you would choose if you win. One of the comments will be drawn at random 3 days after the episode is posted. To browse the available titles in the Old Western Culture series, please visit www.romanroadsmedia.com. So thanks to our good friends over at Roman Roads Media for sponsoring this season of A Perpetual Feast, especially with Wes Callahan being one of the co-stars of this show. We are really honored to continue partnering with Roman Roads and with Wes Callahan to make great content for you. We hope you really enjoy this season. So without further ado, I'll kick it over to Andrew Kern and Wes Callahan and their ongoing conversation of the works of Homer. Enjoy.
Then the assembly broke up. The troops now scattered, each man off to his own ship, their minds on the evening meal and the joy of a full night's sleep. But Achilles wept and wept, thinking of his dear comrade, so that sleep, the all-subduing, got no hold on him. He kept tossing this way and that, missing Patroclus, his manhood, his splendid strength, all he'd been through with him, all the hardships he'd suffered, facing men in battle in the waves of the cruel sea. Recalling these things, he shed large tears, lying now stretched out on his side, but restless, sometimes again on his back, or prone. Then again he'd rise to his feet and wander, distraught, by the seashore. The rising dawn never brought light to sea and to beaches, but he was there. Then he would yoke his swift horses to the chariot and tie on Hector behind it to be dragged. And when he trailed him three times about Menoetius' dead son's mound, he'd go back and rest in his hut, leaving Hector's body stretched out prone in the dust. But Apollo, pitying Hector, preserved his flesh, though mortal, from all unseemly decay, even in death, wrapped the golden aegis round his whole body to save the dragged corpse from disfigurement by Achilles. So Achilles, in his fury, aimed to mutilate noble Hector. But the sight of him stirred...
Hey, Andrew.
What? Wes, what? Hey, Wes, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. What are you reading?
Oh, you know what I'm reading. The famous book 24 of the Iliad.
Indeed. Indeed.
Hey, you know what I was about to get to was I was reading about, you know, the famous Hector being dragged behind the chariot scene.
Yeah.
But I was about to get to where the gods get upset and they actually call a council. Apollo, I think it is, sends Hermes to steal the corpse, to plan that. And then they all get together and they say, we better meet with Zeus. And then Hera actually gets angry. But over at line 64, this is part I should read. Then Zeus, the cloud gatherer, responded to Hera saying, Hera, no need to rage so vehemently at the gods. I wonder if he could have said somewhere in there, Achilles. The honor of these two will not be the same. Yet Hector was more dear to the gods than all the other mortals in Ilion. To me, at least, for he never failed me with gifts I enjoyed. Not once did my altar lack its fair share of the feasting. The libations, the burned fat, our accepted privileges. We'll forget about stealing, bold Hector. No way to do it with Achilles not finding out. His mother is constantly around him both day and night. In fact, I wish that one of you gods would tell Thetis I want her here to give a wise message to her, to make Achilles accept ransom from Priam and give Hector's body back. And bingo, there's the rest. That's book 24 right there. That's Zeus's way of taking charge. Now he's a little less aggressive than he was in 9 and 16. He's not, there's no golden chains here, but he's taking control. And he just laid out what's going to happen in book 24.
Yeah, no dragon gods around by golden chains. in every one of these, here, he's in council, expressing his will and doing his will in council. It's a public thing, just like it was
in 9 and 16? Or 8 and 15?
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Was he? He's in council there as well, expressing his will, not standing off by himself, just saying, "Here's what I'm going to do." But he says it to the other gods, and expects them to listen to him, expects them to accede to his will, expects their consent,
and to help him accomplish it.
And to help him accomplish it, yeah, yeah. Here's what we're going to do, and we'll brook no debate.
So what we've been arguing in the last episode is that there's the three sections of the Iliad, and that in 16 to 24, we're in the third section. You remember in section one, we had argued that 1 through 8 is section one. Book one begins with Achilles becoming angry. Book 8 begins with Zeus aroused to action. Book nine is about Achilles reasserting his anger, but modified a little bit, but he's now withdrawn again, I guess. And then book 15 is about Zeus. It begins with Zeus asserting his will. Now in book 24, we've said Zeus is reasserting his will and achieves it in this book, but we didn't talk about 16. What happens in 16 that is Achilles' anger?
It's, I guess we could say it's an aspect or an outworking of his anger. In our last episode, you read the opening passage, and we talked about how Patroclus had come to Achilles with an idea that Nestor had given to him in book 11 to borrow Achilles's armor. If Achilles won't come back and fight, at least you can borrow his armor, Patroclus, said Nestor, and you can pretend to be Achilles and lead the Myrmidons out in battle and so drive the Trojans away. Patroclus gives this idea at the beginning of book 16 to Achilles, and Achilles agrees with some cautions. That's it. His agreement, his reluctant, kind of hesitant agreement with the idea that Patroclus has, which Homer tells us will be the beginning of evils, the beginning of destruction.
Yeah.
So it's Achilles' decision here to accede to Patroclus' request. He continues to decide not to go out and fight. Even though, by the way, even though at the end of book 15, the Trojans are at the Greek ships and Hector is calling for a torch to set fire to the Greek ships. It's difficult to see how things could be worse for the Greeks at this moment. And Achilles still won't go out and fight, but he agrees to Patroclus's request. And that decision, then opens up what's going to happen in book 16. And then, the rest of this third story.
And what happens in book 16? What's the big
Patroclus, event? Patroclus is killed.
Yeah.
This is a tragic moment. So
by who kills him?
Yeah. And he's killed by Hector. And so then, yeah. So Patroclus is killed by Hector. And so then the rest of the remaining third is Achilles' wrath working out against Hector, because Hector's killed his dear Patroclus.
Yeah. So then book 16 begins almost with Achilles becoming piteous, allowing Patroclus to go into the battle on behalf of the Greek army, on behalf of Achilles, in Achilles' armor, as Achilles, basically.
Yeah.
And he goes into battle and gets killed.
Yeah.
And that is Achilles' re-engagement. So again, just as in book 9, we saw him sort of re-engaging, or, you know, at least agreeing not to leave. Now in 16, he's featured, and this launches it's the beginning of evils. And boy, that's a loaded phrase.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. So there's the three sections, 1-8, 9-15, 16-24. I hope the people listening to the podcast, I hope that you can find sort of bearings from that. What we want to do now is, given that structure, we want to take this podcast, to talk about section 1, and then next time we'll talk about section 2, and then we'll talk about section 3, two podcasts from now. What do you think of that, Wes?
I think that's an excellent idea. That's a good way to look at the structure.
So what I'm thinking is, what I'd be wondering if I'm listening to us talk, I think, is, okay, great. Section 1 begins with book 1, and that's Achilles gets angry, and it ends with book 8, Zeus is aroused to action. What happens in between? So tell me, Wes, what happens in between books 1 and 8?
Well, Achilles does what he promises to do. He withdraws from the fighting, but he wants Zeus he makes a request through his mother Thetis to Zeus, the king of the gods, to restore his honor. And Achilles thinks that that will happen by causing the Greeks to suffer, make the Trojans, the enemy, win for a while, until the Greeks realize that they've erred by offending him, and that they ask for him back. So we see Zeus engaging immediately in book 2. He rouses through a dream. He rouses up. And we don't want to go into too much detail here, because we might be able to later, but he rouses Agamemnon, and now Agamemnon starts the battle. After some false starts, which we could talk about if you think you have time, but basically after some false starts, the battle is really fully engaged in book 5. Zeus stirs up battle between the Greeks and the Trojans so that he can make the Trojans win for a while in response to Achilles' request. The battle comes to an end. Rather, night falls at the end of book 7. And that's the end of the first day of battle, but it's rather inconclusive. And so in book 8, where it ends, where this first section ends, Zeus, after having not done much, apparently, in books 2-7, Zeus holds up his golden scales at the middle of the day, which represents the fate of the Trojans and Greeks, and the Greeks' death day is heavier and sinks to the earth. And that's the indication that Zeus is now going to bring about, is now going to be more active and make the Greeks start suffering at the hands of the Trojans, as he promised Achilles. But it takes till the end of this first section for that to really happen. Which I think, and I'm curious whether you agree with this, Andrew, but I think Homer, just out of artistic motives, is delaying the the main plot for the sake of bringing other things in. I mean, it is an epic poem. He's in no hurry. His audience is in no hurry. They've got no place to go. The evening stretches before them. They want to hear more poetry. So Homer drags out Zeus and caging and, you know, enacting his will, because there's other cool things he can weave into the story. So I skipped over a number of things, but basically in books 1 through 8, Zeus gets the battle going. But it just kind of goes, and he doesn't really exert any effort on behalf of the Trojans against the Greeks until book 8.
Isn't there a duel in a couple books?
Yeah, there are two. This is, you mentioned in an episode or so ago, the principle of the chiasm.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a chiastic structure here too, because in book 3, as soon as Agamemnon, in response to the dream Zeus sends him, as soon as Agamemnon tries to get the army to go to battle, immediately there's an idea pops up that kind of stalls the battle. And the idea is that there'll be a duel of champions between a leading representative on each side. And so in book 3, we have a duel. And then at the end of this day in book 7, there's another duel just before night falls. So the day begins and ends with a duel with battle in between. And there's a chiastic structure.
Let's see if we can push that chiasm even further. If there's a duel in 7 and there's a duel in, is it 2 or 3?
3, yeah.
What happens in book 2?
In book 2, at the beginning, this is the night between books 1 and 2, Zeus has sent a dream to Agamemnon saying, rouse up, I'm going to give you victory, which is not true. Zeus wants Agamemnon to rouse up so the Trojans can have victory for a while. Agamemnon wakes up and tells the men, Zeus has told me we're not going to have victory, let's go home, in a botched attempt to test their valor. And this Odysseus has to save the day. And so finally the men are rallied after these botched attempts in the morning. The men are rallied on the battlefield. And then the entire second half of book 2 is what's called the catalog of ships, where Homer, as the men are marshaling on the assembly ground, Homer goes through and he tells us the leaders of each of the many contingents from Greece and how many ships they came over in and how many men were in each ship and what the country was like that they came from and how long they grow their hair and what's painted on the side of the prows of the ships. So this is a wonderful listing and astonishing for a number of really striking reasons. A wonderful listing of the Greek contingent. And then there's actually a shorter thing done for the Trojan side as well at the end of the book. So the catalog occupies – you know, the entire second half of book 2, and it's a pretty striking feature of the poem.
Huh.
And you said a minute ago, you wonder if we could push this chiasm further, and I'm wondering if you had the catalog of ships in mind.
Well,
if something about book 2 expands the chiastic structure that we saw in 3 and 7 with the duels.
Well,
and I think maybe it does.
What do you think? What are you thinking? What are you seeing?
Well, I'm just making this up as I go along because I hadn't thought of pushing the chiastic structure as you did. But before the duel, there's some obvious things like, you know, morning dawns, and then there's the catalog of ships, and then there's the duel, and in book 7 there's the duel, and then night falls. So, you know, the day is the progress of the day gives us some chiastic structure, and then so does the duel. But I wonder about what's analogous at the end of this first section to the catalog of ships at the beginning in book 2.
And I'll say, do you have something?
Oh, I have some ideas, but I want to hear what you're thinking.
Well, I think there's just simply the fact that, well, first of all, what's tricky about this is that if my theory about the chiasm is right, then the duels aren't what's chiastic, because if I'm onto it, then 1 and 8 are chiastic, are parallel, 2 and 7, 3 and 6, and 4 and 5. But 2 isn't where the first duel is. 3 is.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm not questioning that the duels are chiastic too. In other words, you know, if everybody's still confused on what chiasm, when you go 1, 8, 2, 7, 3, 6, 4, 5, that's a chiastic sequence.
Yes.
And so what I'm wrestling, proposing with, and I have to just say, there's a book called Homer's Cosmic Fabrication, and it's written by a guy named Bruce Hayden, and it's phenomenal on this, and it's extremely technical, but it's when I was despairing of all this chiastic stuff, he rescued my despair. And he actually says that in book 2 and 7, he uses the phrase an aerial survey. In both of these books, he says, you have an aerial survey. So you have the challenge in book 2. You have, you know, the dream sent, the failed challenge, or test, if you like. Odysseus goes into overview, in overdrive to save the day. But then in book 7, you get the corollary to that where night falls, whereas in book 2, it started in the night. And in book 7, the gods are trying to figure out how to end the battle instead of how they're going to begin it. And in book 2, they decide, the gods do, to, I think, to have a duel. In book 7, they use a duel to end it, but the duel doesn't happen until 3. Mm-hmm. And then, so the question then is, okay, if books 2 and 7 are chiastic, if only because the gods began it and ended it in 2 and 7, how are 3 and 6 chiastic? And I'm finding that one, shall we say, a little bit more challenging. So I'm cheating and looking at what Hayden has to say about that.
But there's something else that's at least worth consideration, and that is if we try to find our structures forced by the numbering of the books, it might be partly sort of a trick of the light, because Homer didn't divide the poem into books. He didn't number them. That was later Alexandrian scholars. So if we say, well, this is a problem because that duel happens in book 3 rather than book 2, well, the division between 2 and 3 is a later artificial structure. It's a brilliant one. And I think the Alexandrian scholars who divided the book, the poem into 24 books according to letters of the alphabet for the sake of 24 papyrus scrolls and so on did an absolutely outstanding job. But Homer didn't have that in mind. For him, it's just a poem. And so we could, if we ignore the distinction, the division between book 2 and 3, we might have, in fact, between all the books, we can see the pattern without saying they have to be between books. I'd have a little trouble thinking that Homer.
Perfect.
Yeah.
That means we have another thing we can be contentious about. Because I believe that the Alexandrian scholars were thinking in terms of form and structure and symphonics. And they were deliberately choosing the books and making the books the length they were. If there's two possibilities from my perspective, they were either dividing the books based on the content of each book and noticing that Homer had a rhythm to each book, which we can get to later. Except I'll just say that in each book, there is one major decision and its aftermath. They might have just been doing that. But I think that they also were seeing that Homer's relating books together, because Homer was a weaver. And they were onto that, I think. I may be reading it back. I don't know, but who cares? This is me. I get to make it up as I go along. But I think that they're seeing echoes between things. Now, therefore, go ahead.
You're right. I'm not seeing why you think we disagree.
Come on, Wes.
Well, in the first place, I think it's quite obvious that the Alexandrian scholars made the divisions between books where they did because of the structure and the form of the book. They were brilliant readers of this poem, so they're doing a brilliant job because they're brilliant students of the poem. So the place where they chose to divide the book, they're natural places. But that doesn't mean that that we can't see as any good reader would, the continuity and the flow between the books, such that we could include, say, the opening dream and the failed test and the catalog of ships, and the duel in book 3, we see them as part of part of a unit. There is a natural there is a natural breaking place, but we don't want to push that natural breaking place too far when we think about the division between book two and three, because really the breaking place is just the end of the catalog of ships and back to the story. So we can say, oh, that's a natural place to break the poem, and that's what the Alexandrians did. But that doesn't mean that there's a breach in the story such that the duel is not part of a unit that includes the dream sequence at the beginning of two. In other words, I think we can still see the chiasm.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't think it's illegitimate to do what you're doing. You're saying, but I want to find a chiasm between 2 and 7, not 3 and 7. And I think that's legitimate to do. It also raises another question we're going to have to ask, because some of our readers might be, our listeners might be asking this now. And that is, do you guys really think Homer had all this in mind? Yep. You know, a poem as massive as that, do you really think he had all this in mind? And you and I would both say yes, but we should probably at some point explain why.
I'll tell you why. Because it's mnemonic. No, that's not why. It's two reasons. Because it's beautiful and because it's mnemonic. Okay, so the human soul loves rhythms whether the mind perceives them or not. And so we respond to it. We hear these echoes. We can't necessarily consciously trace them, but we hear the echoes and we love them. But if you're a storyteller, think about this. If you're a storyteller who has to tell a story by memory, how much easier is it to remember what's in the Iliad? In fact, I'm going to leave this challenge to the people listening. If you want to get in your head in a way that you can remember the structure of the whole Iliad so that you can think of any book and say, okay, this is what it's about. My proposition is divide it into the three sections, 1 to 8, 9 to 15, 16 to 24. And then divide each section into a mnemonic pattern, because then you only have to remember 4 or 5 things instead of 24 isolated individual things. And I think it's a brilliant mnemonic device that Homer is using, because beauty is memorable. That's how I'm going to put it. The practical utility follows the beauty, but there's nothing more practical when it comes to the way the mind works than finding beauties and harmonies. So I think that's why he does it.
I think that you're exactly right, and I think there's two different reasons for there's one reason for the mnemonic structure, for the mnemonic capability of the structure, and another one for the beauty, although they're connected. But everybody from C.S. Lewis to Gaylord Perry and the other modern critics who talk about the
wasn't Gaylord Perry a baseball player?
He might have been.
I think you mean Milman.
Milman Perry might have been. Lewis says it's worth looking for things in the structure that suggest they're there because they help the poet remember the poem. They're mnemonic devices. He says, but it's also worth remembering that no good poet would structure his poem for the sake of him remembering it when the audience is who the poem is for. So right. it can't be at the expense of the audience. And the mnemonic structure is not. It also, as you pointed out, is a beautiful thing as aesthetically, which the audience would recognize. Not that I think there would be a great stress on them remembering the poem mnemonically. It might have been, but the mnemonic structure, or the structure such that is easily memorable, gives it aesthetic beauty. It gives it balance and symmetry,
right,
and harmony,
right,
and chiastic structure. It gives it simplicity and elegance, and all those things are easily remembered. But easily remembered is not something the audience is concerned about. That's something the poet is concerned about. The beauty is something the audience is concerned about, or the poet is concerned about on their behalf. I'm making this poem beautiful for the sake of my listeners, he thinks to himself.
And the great thing about beauty is that it's patterned. And the memory loves patterns. So beautiful things. This is why the King James is so much more memorable, right? It's got these rhythmic patterns that makes it easier to memorize. So, you know, the Lord was not careless when he created our souls.
And then we notice too that beauty is patterned, but we also know that there's a key feature of beauty in visual arts and music and all kinds of things, that it's not perfectly patterned, or rather,
right,
it's not patterned so that it's without, it's not utterly balanced, but there's always something put slightly off center for the sake of adding to the beauty. So a picture.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What do you?
That's why That's why Homer tricks us into thinking the duals are the chiasm, but they're a little off center, right? So here's if you look at the human face, and they have these things about, you know, the perfect human face, they're never symmetrical. They're always asymmetrical. And I don't think it's the golden ratio. And the phenomenal thing about the golden ratio is that it's infinite, right? It's symmetrical is balanced and equal, but therefore it's finite. But a golden ratio is infinite. You never ever stop the an irrational number. You never stop the next stage, and it draws you into eternity, because beauty is an eternal thing. I love that.
I agree. Although I don't necessarily agree with your conclusion, because since it's slightly off balance, we could say, as you did, that therefore the dual isn't really the chiasm. Homer's tricked us. Or we could say that is the chiasm, and he just put it off center from our expectation. It's 3 and 7, not 2 and 7, because if we allow ourselves to be driven by the events of the story, that's the dual. But if we allow ourselves to be driven by the numbers of the book, then we'd have to say, well, it should be 2 and 7, so it can't be the dual. But maybe it is the dual. It's just slightly off balance.
While we've been talking, I've been reviewing my notes in the margins of my Iliad, and I'm now going to show you ever so concisely how the chiasm plays out 1, 8, 2, 7, 3, 6, 4, 5. Okay, and then that just like Zeus silenced the gods, that will silence you, and you will be in awe. Okay.
Are you willing to acknowledge that there are layers of complexity?
Oh my goodness, yes.
All right, then. So the duals could still be a chiasm, even if they don't fit your notes.
Oh, yes. There can be a chiastic use of the duals. But this is what I'm trying to do, is kind of strip it to something very simple, strip it bare, so that for the reader who wants to just kind of follow the sequence and see where he is in the book, it's relatively easy to find. Because we've probably lost all of them, because they're all saying, look, I want to know what happened. Okay. But I want to use this to show you what happened. Okay. In book one, we're on Olympus. And there's an assembly. Sorry, we're on Earth and there's an assembly. It ends with another assembly on Olympus. So book one is about assemblies, but on Earth and Olympus. Book eight, we're in an assembly again. And Zeus is taking control in book eight. In book one, it's early in the day. In book eight, it's night. Okay. So that's the chiasm of 1 and 8. In book two, we have the battle begun by the gods, particularly Zeus, but he sends dream and so on. And so the battle is begun in book two, and the battle is ended in book seven. In book three, we see a rescue. There is the duel, but that launches the action. We see a major rescue by Aphrodite, who rescues Menelaus. And in book six, we see Zeus rescue. Oh, shoot. What was his name? Who does Zeus rescue? Is it Diomedes Zeus rescues? No. Who does Zeus rescue in book six?
I don't remember.
Rescue me from my folly.
Don't remember. He rescues Hector.
Trust me. Maybe that's it. Yeah, because they go into the city, right? They go into the city, and we hear this is the warm and fuzzy that nobody can get over, where everybody thinks Hector is so wonderful because he holds his baby up and you know, he screams, and it's such a cute scene that everybody thinks Hector's wonderful, and they fail to recognize the decline of this character through the Iliad. But oh, that's a side point. Don't worry about that right now.
Yeah, that's another thing we're going to argue about, by the way.
I think so.
But I'm telling you that I will disagree.
Okay, good. Because again, I want to be able to silence you and make you hear me with awe.
Good luck.
As I hang you from the golden thread of my rhetoric. So 3 and 6 involve a major rescue by a god, and that's chiastic. And then 4 and 5 are both. I'll just reduce this to books. 4 and 5 are where the battle is most intense. And for now, because of time, I'll leave it at that. But so if we go now in sequence, forget about the poetic structure. In book one, we see Achilles withdraws from battle, and the gods all agree that we're going to go forward here, and the Greek camp is in decay. In book two is in chaos. In book two, the battle is begun when Agamemnon tests is prepared for, when Agamemnon tests his people, and they make a joke and folly of Agamemnon because what a stupid test. Hey, you guys, if you want to go home now, you'll go home. Oh, gee whiz, they want to go home instead of die for me. What could be wrong? But they do. Book three, then, is where they decide, okay, let's just settle this 10-year-old war once and for all. Paris and Menelaus, Paris who stole Helen and Menelaus who was married to Helen. Now they're going to fight it out. And oh, jeepers, Paris is a dandy and can't fight well. And Menelaus is about to kill him. He's dragging him by the helmet. And Aphrodite rescues Paris and sends him back to his bedroom where he sends Helen to him. In kind of an ironic but Aphroditean twist. In book four, the battle explodes. In book five, the armies clash. In book six, the battle is continuing, and that's where, but we withdraw from the battle for a moment to see the Trojan inside the Trojan city, get to know them on a personal basis a little bit. And then Zeus rescues the person that I said before, I forgot. So I'm embarrassed by that.
Well, but yeah, there's no rescue in book six, actually, but it's close enough.
Oh, I think you're wrong.
Okay.
I'll look it up again. But in book seven, it is impossible that I could ever be wrong.
Right. I know that. What am I saying? But keep going with your, narrative.
It's where Diomedes and Glaucus face each other. There's even a parallel structure. You got Hector and the heralds, Troy. They talk to the Trojans. There's a dedication and prayer. And this Athena and Zeus each refuse the prayer. So that's three and six. But anyway, it's conceivable that I got a detail wrong, but who cares? I'm never formally wrong. I can only be wrong on detail. Exactly. Where was I? Okay, so then in book seven, we see the second duel, and this time they actually do fight. They're about to destroy each other, and the gods step in and say, let's put an end to this. It's too late. So they sort of make the sun go down and the end of their wrath. Then in book eight, as you pointed out, that's when Zeus is aroused and he does the golden scale, and that's an assembly on Olympus, and nighttime falls. And it's one of the most beautiful passages in the book is when you get to the end of book eight, and he says, 1,000 fires were burning there in the plain, and beside each one sat 50 men in the flare of the blazing firelight. Yeah. And standing each beside his chariot, champing white barley and oats, the horses waited for the dawn to mount to her high place. So, you know, we've got this, you know, the greatness of Zeus is kind of the theme of book eight. Yeah. So that's the excessively rapid summary of the action in books one through eight, with a little petty argument about where the chiasm goes.
Can you briefly summarize again how people could be helped to remember this first section? What is the biggest picture structure for books one through eight?
If you can remember that in book one and eight, there's an assembly, a major assembly. In book two and seven, you have the beginning and the end of the battle. In 3 to 6, you have these rescues, which apparently you're denying happened in six. So let me offer this then as maybe an easier thing. In 3 and 6, to demonstrate, in 3 and 6, you see an appeal to a god that is rejected, that is denied. And in 4 and 5, you see the battle raging.
Okay. I think that is an interesting way to remember it, and it might turn out to be useful for a number of people. The more we can get the bird's eye view or the aerial view, the big picture, and the more we have balance structures, the easier it'll be to remember the story. So I like that. I'm not sure. Well, I'll hold off my reservations. I do like that.
you're allowed to disagree with me.
Well, but for the purpose of what we're doing, I think that's nice. That's a nice way to remember it. I think there's evidence. I'll have to go back and look at some of my underlined sections and some of the books I've got on my shelves. I think there's evidence that people various of Homer's readers in history have done things like that, tried to remember the outline of the Iliad and or the Odyssey by that sort of mnemonic technique.
Well, the memory loves patterns, because pattern implies repetition, right? It implies an echo. And how much easier to remember something if you know it somewhere else?
Yeah. So where are we then? So we have a way of finding structures that would help help our memory for the first section, and we have the first section begun with the wrath of Achilles and ended with the will of Zeus, and then we have a chiastic structure that rises to battle and descends from battle, and the battle is within that. Within that theme of having expressing the anger of Achilles and the will of Zeus, or it's moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. I think did I mention? Mm-hmm. I might have mentioned in a previous episode, just because this tickles me, that J.T. Shepherd giving the speech on the Iliad back in the 1930s at some English public school, and being so brilliant that afterwards someone asked him if he could see his notes, and Shepherd pulls a scrap of paper out of his pocket. You know, yeah, here's my notes, and it said Zeus, Agamemnon, Zeus.
Yeah. That's a mnemonic, right?
It is. It's whatever it meant to Shepherd is a chiastic form.
You know, some of our readers have probably enjoyed the Iliad once or twice or three times already. What I found is that by the third and fourth time, it started to lift off the page and become three-dimensional and living. And having this kind of mnemonic structure makes you... see how everything fits together dynamically, so that you have all kinds of characters who start talking to each other in your mind, and it's amazing how much more you do remember. But it doesn't become an academic exercise of remembering; it becomes a mode of enjoying the story more deeply.
Yeah.
So I don't want to turn this into a, hey, beat your kid up and make him memorize this, but use this to help you enter into more of the joy of the story, because it's so beautiful.
And like in other areas of our lives, the techniques and the helps are the crutches, if you will, that help us in the beginning stage lose their necessity later on, but that doesn't mean that they lose their interest or even their beauty. So the more you and I have read the Iliad, I'm sure the less we depend on mnemonic devices to remember what's in it, just because we're familiar with the story. I don't have to make notes anymore to remember things about my wife. Well, some things I do, but I'm less dependent upon artificial ways of remembering things about her because of our interpenetrated life and our participation in each other. And the more we participate in the Iliad, the more we'll still find the structures, the chiasms and the parallelisms interesting, but the less they'll be necessary for remembering the book, because it'll become so much a part of us.
Yeah, that's good. And that's why I would go back to what I said earlier, that the practical benefit of the beauty of the rhythmic structure, which is beautiful, it's musical, right? This is Musis. Mm-hmm. The practical benefit is that you remember it better, but the objective is to make it beautiful.
So,
you know, what we want is to enjoy the beauty of it. And if we do that, we will, I think, remember it better.
Yeah. I agree. And the more we can encourage, our students that we teach to see it this way, I think the better off that they'll be.
Yeah. You know what? Wes, we're out of time.
Okay.
We're way out of time. We went over time.
That happens a lot, doesn't it?
We got to discipline ourselves, though, because we got to be responsible to these poor people listening to us. Well, listen, let's get back together again soon and talk about the next section, books 9 through 15, and I'll try not to blunder on where the chiasm comes in.
I don't think you blundered. That sounds good. I like that.
Okay. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
Hey, Wes.
Andrew.
May the Lord remember you in his kingdom.
And you, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.